Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
This season of The Cold Podcast includes descriptions of rape, sexual assault, murder, and domestic violence. Please, take care in listening. Weber County Attorney Reed Richards believed he had the Ogden City rapist in his sights. He had charged Carrie Hartman with felony crimes for a string of home invasion sexual assaults that had occurred across the city.
We had one of the victims who had gone to a bar one night and heard over the loudspeaker somebody announcing and recognized the voice of the person that had broken into her home. That turned out to be Carrie Hartman.
Carrie faced charges in four separate cases. Police suspected him in several more, but all were short on evidence.
We didn't have DNA back then. Now we might have approached it a little differently. If you could get DNA samples from each of the women and tie it to him, that would be different. We didn't have that.
Only one of the women had picked Carrie's picture out of a photo lineup.
And that's not really unusual because he came in the dark. He didn't let them see his face.
Another of the women, a person I'm calling Caroline, had told police she didn't want to look at a picture lineup. She wanted the real thing. Reed didn't have much time to make a lineup happen. The court had scheduled a preliminary hearing. Each of the four women were going to testify. Reed knew the judge might not advance the case if none of them could say with confidence Carrie was the man who had assaulted them.
It was challenging. And many of those women, once they went to the police, actually moved because they didn't want whoever it was to know where they were at.
Carrie had managed to get out of jail ahead of that hearing after his parents put up their own property as collateral for his bail. Reed was fighting that, too, trying to protect his witnesses.
People here were really frightened about going outside.
The vast majority of rape and sexual assault cases are committed by someone known to the victim. The Ogden City rapist cases were rare exceptions. Police believed Carrie Hartman, in some instances, stalked his victims. The idea of a stranger sneaking into the homes of sleeping women should make you shudder. It's terrifying, but also very, very uncommon. Still, it had happened in Ogden repeatedly through 1984, 85, 86, and 87.
Time and time again, same scenario.
So the threat felt very real. Police were telling women in Ogden not to go out alone after dark, especially if they were young, single, and had children. And it had been a little over a year since one rape victim, Joyce Yost, had reported her assault.
He grabbed me by the throat, and he was forceful.
Then disappeared days before she was supposed to testify at trial. So for any of these Ogden rape victims, heading to court must have felt like a dangerous gamble. Reed arranged to hold a lineup for Caroline the day before she was to testify at Carrie Hartman's preliminary hearing. He told me both the lineup and the prelim were tough asks to make.
Because you're trying to find the person that's willing to go through what's going to be a nasty, nasty time.
But Caroline rose to the task. We met her back in episode 3. She was the woman who had fallen asleep watching an old World War II movie and woken to the sound of a strange man turning off the TV. Now, a year later, Caroline came into another darkened room along with Reed, Ogden Police Detective Chris Zimmerman, and a man she didn't know, Carrie Hartman's defense attorney Kevin Sullivan. I reached out to Kevin to ask about his recollections of this lineup, but he didn't respond.
But the actual lineup was done after he had an attorney, and I think they took part in deciding who was going to be standing in the lineup, and that's how the brother got in there.
You heard that right. Carrie Hartman's younger brother, Jack Hartman, was in the lineup with him. Carrie's cousin, David Hartman, stood in the lineup too, and I've been told David was a dead ringer for Carrie.
As I recall, the brother tried to look like the person had been when they broke in, and Hartman tried to change his appearance.
So when Caroline went to try and point out the man who had assaulted her, three of the guys in that lineup looked an awful lot alike, which was unusual. Lineups were typically filled out with an assortment of jail inmates. Caroline looked at the seven men, three of whom were related. She was on one side of a pane of mirrored glass, the men were on the other, along with a jailer who held a card printed with phrases the rapist had used. One by one, the men picked up a telephone receiver and read from the card. Number one,
"You'll wake the kids. I'll blow their heads off."
Caroline listened on the other end of that phone line. Number two,
"You'll I'll wake the kids. I'll blow their heads off.
She had told police the man who'd attacked her had a distinctive voice. Number three.
You'll wake the kids. I'll blow their heads off.
Detective Chris Zimmerman watched Caroline as she listened. Number four.
You'll wake the kids. I'll blow their heads off.
You'll wake the kids.
You'll wake the kids.
I'll blow their heads off. I'll blow their heads off.
The second she heard number four's voice, Caroline began to shake. Zimmerman wrote on a notepad. She appeared shocked and frightened. Carrie Hartman was number four. But he looked different than he had a year earlier. He had shaved his mustache and trimmed his hair. The rest of the men in the lineup took their turns reading the card. Reed then asked Caroline if any of them stood out to her. Number four hit me really strong, she said. But he don't have a mustache, and his mustache was like number six's. Caroline peered through the glass. These two even look like they could be brothers, she said. Four and six. She asked Reed if the two were related. He said he couldn't tell her. She had four and six each read the card again. They even sound the same, she said. Caroline wasn't sure which man to pick. They were just so alike. But according to a transcript of the lineup, she told Reed she leaned more toward number six, the one with a mustache. She didn't know it, but she had just picked Carrie's cousin, David Hartman. In his journal that night, Carrie wrote he had scored a win at the lineup. The invisible woman on the other side of the mirrored glass had not identified him.
In other words, Dave Hartman saved our buns.
This is Cold, Season 3, Episode 5, Nighthawk. From KSL Podcasts, I'm Dave Cawley. One of the four women Carrie Hartman stood accused of sexually assaulting had tried to pick her attacker out of a lineup. She had wavered between pointing out Carrie or his look-alike cousin, David Hartman. She had told Weber County Attorney Reed Richards she couldn't tell the two men apart.
Right. Got pretty close. It was helpful.
Yeah.
It was better than nothing.
The woman, who I'm calling Caroline, took the stand at Carrie's preliminary hearing the day after the lineup. She pointed to Carrie when asked if her attacker was in the courtroom.
Yeah, of course they always do that.
This was good enough for the judge.
She was the only one that could pick him out of a lineup. And even that was kind of contested with the little foray with his brother and all of that.
The fact Caroline had pointed out someone different a day prior didn't prevent him from binding Carrie over in each of the four cases. That meant, in the judge's eyes, enough evidence existed to proceed to the next step, arraignment, where Carrie would enter his pleas. But first, there was the question of bail. Reed, the prosecutor, told the judge Carrie's $105,000 bail amount wasn't good enough. The public would remain at risk so long as Carrie was out of jail. The judge agreed and increased the bail.
Judge Browning set a new bail at $135,000.
That again comes from a journal Carrie was keeping as all this was going down. I've made a couple references to it now, and you're probably wondering how I know what Carrie wrote. So let me tell you how I got my hands on the journal. Ogden police had arrested Carrie on suspicion of rape on May 8th. He'd bailed out of jail on the 9th, then been rearrested on the 12th. Carrie had bailed out for a second time on the 16th.
May 16th, got out of Weber County Jail. Dad and Mom picked me up.
It was after Carrie bailed out the second time he started jotting notes in this journal.
May 18th, at 6:35 I left for the college.
He chronicled where he went and what he did in the days leading up to his preliminary hearing. A lot of it's honestly pretty dull.
Arrived at the college at 6:50 a.m. Parked in rear of heat plant.
But there are bits that are more illuminating. Carrie wrote about how he had worked with his attorney to set up having his brother and cousin in the lineup.
Went with Kevin Sullivan to his office. Question, Jack and Dave in the lineup? What time and where?
Those words are why I can tell you Carrie had engineered this bit of subterfuge. Carrie also wrote about reuniting with a woman named Shauna Hall after he got out of jail.
Shauna brought me out to TJ's at 5:30. I watched a National Geographic TV show on Channel 22. about crocodiles.
I mentioned Shauna in the last episode. Kerry had met her through one of his lingerie survey phone calls, and to the best of my knowledge, they had started dating around October of 1986, a year after Cherie Warren's disappearance. Kerry and Shauna had discussed marriage just weeks later, even though Shauna was at that time married. Shauna had separated from her husband in March of 87, working toward a goal of marrying Kerry. His arrest in the Ogden City rapist investigation 2 months later hadn't dissuaded her. To the contrary, she even bought Kerry a car while he was out on bail.
If the 1973 red VW doesn't turn out to be sound, Shauna Hall reserves the right to a full refund.
Shauna was in deep. Most of Kerry's writings I've referenced so far this season came from papers seized by police during the two searches of his apartment. But this journal covered a time after those searches, as Kerry and his parents were in and out of court, arguing over bail.
God only knows I'll probably never get out of jail. It would be a miracle.
As I mentioned a couple minutes ago, the judge had upped the bail amount after the preliminary hearing.
May 29. We're trying to arrange bail. I'm going to try to sell all of my furniture.
Kerry's furniture wasn't worth $135,000. He landed back in jail. He was in from May 29th to July 9th. Kerry's girlfriend slash fiance Shauna took care of his financial affairs during that time, and she took custody of his journal. Someone broke into Shauna's house that summer. A South Ogden police sergeant named Brad Birch went to investigate. Shauna reportedly told him she believed her estranged husband, Roger Hall, was responsible. You might remember from the last episode, Roger had filed a civil lawsuit against Kerry, accusing him of luring his wife Shauna into infidelity. Shauna gave Sergeant Brad Birch a pile of papers, reportedly saying she thought her estranged husband Roger had rifled through them, looking for evidence for his lawsuit. She wanted police to fingerprint the papers and arrest Roger for burglary. Sergeant Birch had taken the pile of papers back to South Ogden Police Headquarters. He looked through it. He saw business cards, phone bills, and pay stubs, some in Kerry Hartman's name. This is what's sometimes known in the sports world as an unforced error, or to use the modern slang, a cell phone, a mistake inflicted by and upon oneself. But it was a stroke of luck for police. Sergeant Birch picked up his phone and called Ogden Police Detective Chris Zimmerman.
I went to South Ogden Police Department on July 15, 1987, and read through the files.
These are Zimmerman's words from a warrant he wrote targeting Kerry's journal.
There was a brown, spiral-type paper notebook that was being used as a diary, listing dates on each page and events that happened on that day. The events included the writer of the diary being arrested, the times he spent in jail, speaking with his attorney, Kevin Sullivan, and getting Jack Hartman and Dave Hartman to be in the lineup he had to be in.
Zimmerman read Kerry's comment about how his cousin David had saved his buns at the lineup.
I feel this could be incriminating evidence on Kerry Hartman, and I have probable cause to believe the diary was written by Kerry Hartman, and it contains evidence of illegal conduct.
Incriminating. Because why would Kerry have gone to the trouble of having lookalikes in the lineup unless he was afraid the woman on the other side of the glass was going to identify him? A judge signed the warrant, allowing Zimmerman to take the journal. That's how it ended up in the hands of Ogden police. I wanted to know what secrets it might hold about Cherie Warren, so I went looking for it more than 30 years later. Cracking Kerry Hartman's diary for the first time in decades wasn't the revelatory experience I had hoped, but it's interesting for what it doesn't say. There's not one mention in those pages of Cherie Warren, even though Kerry was writing during the period police were searching around Causey Reservoir for the body reported by the anonymous caller.
No report of the body that I found.
The journal reveals as police were hunting for Cherie, Kerry was watching Star Search and Hollywood Insider and arranging to have his cousin impersonate him at the lineup. Weber County Attorney Reed Richards had faced a choice during the summer of 1987. Should he go full throttle on all four of the sexual assault cases he had filed against Kerry Hartman simultaneously, or should he take them on one at a time?
Well, there are a couple of thoughts that come into play. The evidence certainly is part of it.
So let's talk about evidence in cases of rape and sexual assault. Ogden Police Detective Shane Miner had interacted with some of the women in the Ogden City rapist cases.
You know, to see that look on their face and to see the fear that they had. When you see that, you begin to understand better their lack of wanting to come forward with it.
In spite of that fear, each of the four women Carrie had been charged with assaulting had undergone physical exams following their attacks. Evidence gathered from those forensic exams, what's sometimes called the rape kit, can include clothing, bedding, swabs of body cavities, hair combings, fingernail scrapings, and bodily fluids.
At that time, you didn't have DNA like you have today, so there's been a lot of advancements made in that.
DNA today enables forensic scientists to identify people by their unique individual gene signatures. But that tech wasn't quite ready for the courtroom in 1987. Instead, forensic science in Carrie Hartman's case focused on serology, the study of bodily fluids. Serology in rape cases involved looking for blood, saliva, or semen on the body, clothing, or bedding of a victim, then comparing that against samples taken from a suspect. I know this is dry and sciencey, but trust me, it's important. If a suspect and victim had different blood types, and fluids matching the suspect's type were found on the victim, it could suggest, but not prove, the suspect had had physical contact with the victim. Utah State Crime Lab tested the evidence gathered in the four cases for which Carrie was charged. I have those reports. They show two of the women had type A blood, the other two were type O. Vaginal swabs from all four also revealed the presence of sperm. Reed, the prosecutor, asked the court to compel Carrie to provide a semen sample for comparison. Carrie's attorney, Kevin Sullivan, told Reed his client was willing to provide the semen sample. They were confident it would exonerate Carrie, because as you might remember, Carrie had had a vasectomy. That meant his semen shouldn't contain any sperm. So the logic went, Carrie couldn't be the rapist because the lab had found sperm in all four rape kits. Kevin wanted Reed's word he'd drop the charges if forensic analysis of Carrie's semen sample excluded him as the rapist. Reed agreed to drop the charges if that's what the evidence showed, and he put that promise in writing. Sure enough, there were no sperm cells in Carrie's semen. But for Reed, that wasn't enough to exclude Carrie as the suspect. Here's why. The crime lab had also determined Carrie had type B blood and had found evidence of type B blood in one of the rape kits, Caroline's.
So even without DNA, we had a very unusual type of blood that was found inside of the rape kit, which I thought was pretty good evidence.
The lab didn't specify if Carrie's blood was B positive or B negative. When I talked to Reed, he remembered it as B negative, but I have some documents that suggest it could be B positive. The important takeaway here is both B types are less common. The American Red Cross says only about 1 out of every 10 people have either B positive or B negative blood.
So when you've got the identification and you've got the blood type and then you've got the confession or statements that he made to Zimmerman, that was clearly the best case.
Reed decided to take Caroline's case to trial. He put the other three cases he had filed against Carrie on hold. Carrie's defense attorney, Kevin Sullivan, didn't like this at all. He told the judge the lack of sperm in Carrie's semen sample proved Carrie hadn't committed the rape. Kevin filed paperwork in court accusing Reed of acting in bad faith. Kevin also tried to have Carrie's statement to Detective Chris Zimmerman on the day of his arrest barred from evidence. He said Zimmerman hadn't advised Carrie of his Miranda rights as they were driving around to the homes of the various women. Miranda rights include the right to remain silent, the right to have an attorney present during questioning, and so on. The court held a hearing on this days before the trial. The prosecution pointed out Carrie had gone through specific training on Miranda rights when he had signed on to the Ogden Police Reserves. In other words, Carrie knew his rights well. Carrie's friend Dave Moore, the guy who owned the sewing machine repair shop, was in the courtroom that day as well.
One of his victims, according to one of the detectives, he got the name and address from my store he happened to be in. She brought in a sewing machine. And he copied down her name, address. And that was one of the break-ins.
That had to have hurt to have heard that.
Yeah, it was tough.
Prosecutor Reed Richards put Dave Moore on the stand, and asked him to describe the conversation he had had with Carrie after Carrie's arrest. We talked about that in episode 4.
He put you in a tough position.
He did. Extremely tough.
As a refresher, David called the jail and asked to speak with Carrie. Carrie had allegedly come on the line and told Dave he had done some bad things, felt ashamed about it, and believed the Ogden detectives were just trying to help. Dave told me Reed seemed to sense his discomfort over testifying against his friend Carrie.
He says, "Dave, this is probably the toughest thing you ever had to do, isn't it?" I said, "Yeah, definitely." And then he basically excused me. But as I was walking by Carrie and his attorney, Carrie says, "Why, Dave, why?" And his attorney says, "He didn't have a choice."
I'm assuming you got subpoenaed for that.
I did.
So you literally did not have a choice.
To be honest with you, there were so many news trucks out front. I just got the heck out of there. I didn't want anything to do with it.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Life is full of stresses. Navigating the ups and downs alone can be a real challenge. I'm a big believer in talking through troubles. Sometimes just the act of voicing what's on my mind with someone I can trust helps me see a path forward that previously seemed invisible. And there are definitely times where talking to someone who is not part of my inner circle of friends or family can be a benefit. If you're looking for someone to talk to about your life, consider trying BetterHelp. It's a service that connects you with a licensed therapist who can help you along that journey of self-discovery. It's entirely online, which means you can suit it to your own schedule. You start by filling out a brief questionnaire, which helps you find the right therapist. And if it's not the right fit, you can change therapists at any time for no additional charge. Discover your potential with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/cold today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/cold. Carrie Hartman's trial for the attack on Caroline began on September 15, 1987. The prosecution and defense settled on a jury of 5 men and 3 women. Carrie strode into the courthouse with his attorney the next morning. TV news cameras were there. So was Carrie's reporter friend, Larry Lewis.
Prosecutors say their key evidence in the case against Hartman are statements he made to police at the time of his arrest, information from police lab tests, and a victim's testimony.
If you're wondering why Carrie's personal friend was reporting on his trial, so am I. More on that in a minute. Carrie wore a tan suit, was clean-shaven, had lightened his hair, and he donned a pair of oversized glasses with smoked lenses once seated at the defense table. This all had the effect of making him look significantly different than he had a year and a half earlier when the attack on Caroline had taken place. The chameleon act didn't faze Caroline.
This morning in court, the victim identified Carrie Hartman as the rapist. County Attorney Reed Richards told the jury that Hartman's own statements to police proves he's guilty. He said Hartman told investigators facts only the rapist could have known, and Richards said evidence found on the victim will link Hartman to the rape.
The judge had rejected the defense's request to toss out Carrie's incriminating comments to Ogden police. Cherie Warren's mom, Mary Sorensen, sat in the courtroom as Caroline testified. She stared at Carrie from across the room and noted any time he glanced her direction, he refused to make eye contact. Mary received a jolt when Caroline said the man who had raped her had told her, "I've killed before and can kill again."
But defense attorney Kevin Sullivan said this is a case of mistaken identity. He said the victim first identified another man as her attacker during a police lineup and says she changed her mind about who raped her after seeing a TV news report about Hartman's arrest. But the key evidence in the defense case is the medical exam of the victim after the rape. It showed the presence of sperm. The defense says since Hartman had a vasectomy several years ago and is physically unable to produce sperm, there's no evidence that Hartman raped the victim in this case. The victim testified that she had sexual relations with another man a few days before she was raped, and because of that, the prosecution argues that the medical report does not rule out Hartman as the rapist.
That last bit deserves a bit more explanation. Caroline had met up with her estranged husband at a motel a few days before she was attacked. At the trial, her estranged husband testified they had had sex. That meant he could have been the source of the sperm detected in the rape kit. But the estranged husband didn't have B-type blood. Remember, the crime lab had found evidence of B-type blood in swabs taken from Caroline's body. and the semen sample Carrie Hartman had provided showed he had B-type blood. Detective Chris Zimmerman took the stand and described how Carrie had identified Caroline's house as they had driven around Ogden together. Carrie's attorney, Kevin Sullivan, challenged Zimmerman, suggesting this tactic had been a breach of police protocol. He insinuated Zimmerman had a history of violating procedure, noting the detective had once issued a phony parking ticket to President Ronald Reagan. Kaylin, the woman who'd rented the basement of her house to Carrie, testified too. You heard Kaylin's words read by a voice actor in the last episode. She's the woman who described hearing an argument between Carrie and Cherie Warren, then a thump, and all going quiet. She had thought it had happened the night Cherie disappeared. Kaylin wasn't asked to tell that story from the witness stand. Instead, she talked about the odd schedule Carrie had kept in the months afterward.
There were times when he would leave at odd hours. It would seem like he'd get a call or just up and leave after midnight. It would be 1 or 2 in the morning, and he would return an hour or two later.
This comes from a formal statement Kaylin provided to Ogden police, read by a voice actor. In it, Kaylin called Carrie a nighthawk.
He never seemed to sleep. He'd get up as I was going out jogging about 5:30 a.m. and be gone to work when I'd come in about 6 or 6:30. I could never survive on the sleep he got.
Carrie testified in his own defense. He talked about his interrogation by Ogden Police Detective John Stubbs the day of his arrest. He said Stubbs had an explicit photo Carrie had taken of an Ogden police officer's wife. That photo would come out of the Supper Club album Detective Jack Bell had found in Carrie's apartment while serving one of the search warrants.
She was a woman I had an affair with.
The Salt Lake Tribune quoted Carrie as saying from the witness stand. Carrie said Detective Stubbs had threatened to share that embarrassing information with Carrie's family if he didn't confess. Carrie contended he had held his ground, even in the face of that threat.
I had never seen the victim. I don't know her. At no time did I ever have sex with her.
As for his appearance at the lineup, Carrie explained he had shaved off his mustache after getting out of jail because he'd felt disgusted at how dirty the jail was and he wanted to be clean.
My parents taught me that cleanliness is next to godliness.
None of this swayed the jury. They deliberated just over 3 hours before returning a guilty verdict.
After the verdict, Richards says it was Hartman's own statements that helped prosecutors win
That's
their conviction.
Without the confession, you can narrow it down to a small group of people, but probably not to one person. So I think you probably would not be able to make the case without the confession.
The defense contended all along those statements were not a confession, but that police were hearing what they wanted.
They were damaging, but as you say, they weren't actually confessions. They were more in the way of statements, as our argument was. I think it was more of a misinterpretation of what was said.
Again, the reporter in this clip is Larry Lewis.
The guilty verdict brought tears to family members and even some jurors in the courtroom. The victim agreed to shed her cloak of anonymity and talked with reporters about her feelings, she said, as a way to help other rape victims.
I think if I have the strength to finally be on camera, that maybe it'll give other people strength through me.
This KSL-TV story showed Caroline's face, but it didn't identify her by name, and that's partly why I'm still using a pseudonym for her. Caroline had blazed a trail the other women might follow.
How about the other victims? What would you tell them?
I'll be praying for you, and I'll be there to support you.
She said now she can move her children back to the state and begin a new life.
You can't see it, obviously, since this is a podcast, but in that TV news clip, Larry Lewis stands holding a microphone in front of Caroline. I think to myself when I watch it, did she know the reporter she was talking to was a personal friend of the man a jury had just convicted of raping her? In the last episode, I took you to Larry Lewis's doorstep.
You and Carrie were friends back at the time Cherie Warren disappeared, and you were involved in covering his rape trial in 1987.
Right.
I wanted to talk to Larry not only about how Detective Jack Bell had questioned him in the Cherie Warren investigation, but also about the ethics and optics of his reporting on Carrie's rape case.
I need to know if that was disclosed to KSL, that you had a friendship with him at the time you were covering that story.
I disclosed that I knew Carrie, or I was an acquaintance of Carrie, while I was covering that trial, yes.
Okay.
An acquaintance. I asked to whom specifically Larry had disclosed, He said to KSL's assignment desk editor.
And at the end of that trial, my assignment editor, my supervisor, said I did a good job in being neutral, recovering the case.
Okay, and we'll ask him.
Yeah.
I did ask. I called Larry's former assignment editor, who told me he didn't remember having this conversation about Larry's relationship with Kerry Hartman. I went up the management ladder, the former news director. That person also didn't remember Larry Lewis disclosing to KSL he had had a personal relationship with Kerry Hartman, a relationship Larry repeatedly minimized during our brief conversation.
When you say friendship, I think that's my friendship with him. It was more of an acquaintance. We played handball and poker a couple times, and that's as far as it went.
The Society of Professional Journalists publishes a code of ethics for reporters. It says journalists should avoid conflicts of interest, real or perceived, and disclose unavoidable conflicts. In Larry Lewis's case, there were two disclosures to consider, one to KSL, his employer, and the other to the public who might see his stories. I can say with certainty, Larry didn't disclose his connection to Kerry Hartman to the viewers. When I raised this point to Larry, he challenged me by asking if I believed his stories about the trial were fair. I told him as far as I could tell, the stories were factually accurate. But that didn't absolve him of a possible perception of bias.
I guess you could view it that way. I mean, there are lots of reporters who cover issues that they know because they have a personal involvement in that issue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what they call specialists.
There's another line in that code of ethics that tells reporters to expose unethical conduct in journalism, including within their own organizations. So when I learned Larry Lewis had a personal relationship with Kerry Hartman and didn't disclose that fact to the public when reporting on Kerry's rape case, I felt a duty to address it.
Just be fair. I mean, you know, I know you think you might have something interesting with me, but I'm just a citizen. And as a reporter, I came forward to report what I knew. And I know you want it to be more interesting than that, and it's not. If you're going to be fair, you need to know that.
Well, being fair is why I'm here on your doorstep asking the questions.
Weber County Attorney Reed Richards had won a significant victory, securing a conviction against Kerry Hartman in one of the four rape cases.
Then the question was, number one, do the other victims want to go forward? And for the most part, that was not what they wanted to do. They knew he was locked away, and they didn't want to go through the harassment of having to go through the questioning and the public scrutiny and the newspaper articles and all the things that go with the rape prosecution. And the evidence in those cases was not as good. You didn't have the ID and you didn't have the blood.
Reed asked the court to delay the three other trials until after sentencing in Caroline's case. The judge agreed and commissioned a pre-sentence report from an agency called Utah Adult Probation and Parole. A pre-sentence report's a summary of all available information about a criminal defendant a judge can use when deciding how harsh or lenient to be in imposing a sentence. A state investigator spent the next 3 weeks preparing the report. He reviewed the police records from Caroline's case, interviewed the detectives and attorneys, and drafted a synopsis. In Utah, pre-sentence reports are confidential because they often contain a great deal of sensitive personal information about offenders, their families, and victims. I've obtained a copy of Kerry's, but I'm being selective about what I share from it. The report showed the investigator interviewed Kerry himself, who again denied any sexual contact with Caroline, consensual or otherwise.
I'm still in shock. I have a lot of anxiety.
Kerry provided this written statement for the pre-sentence report.
I have a lot of fears and apprehensions about being incarcerated for the charge that I've been convicted of.
Kerry said he had only failed the two lie detector tests he had taken because of his anxieties.
I made statements to Detective Zimmerman that I felt positively would prove my innocence. These statements were turned around and used against me. I'm completely innocent of these crimes.
The investigator spoke with Caroline, who told him Kerry had taken everything from her. There's not a man, woman, or child on earth safe when he is out on the streets, the report quoted Caroline as saying. The investigator spoke to Kerry's mom and dad, Donna and Bill Hartman. They said they'd been, quote, completely unaware of Carrie's history of making sexual phone calls. You and I know this was untrue. Heidi Posnien told us in episode 1 how Carrie had tried to lure her up the canyon for that so-called date in 1971, but deputies intervened. Heidi's husband, John, had then confronted Carrie's dad, Bill Hartman.
They went to find his dad at the golf course. He was playing golf again.
Bill Hartman told the investigator he didn't believe his son had committed any rapes. Bill planned to stand by Carrie. So too did Carrie's girlfriend slash fiancé, Shauna Hall. She reportedly told the investigator she believed Caroline was lying and insisted Carrie wasn't a violent person. Carrie, for his part, told the investigator he worried over what might happen between he and Shauna going forward.
I'm mentally and physically exhausted for worrying about my family, my son, my relationship with my fiancé, and what will happen to these relationships.
The investigator spoke to both of Carrie's ex-wives. They painted a far different picture of how Carrie acted in his relationships. They described detailed instances of physical and sexual abuse at Carrie's hands. I already shared some of that in episode 1, so I won't repeat the stories here. The investigator wrote, it's, quote, evident that the defendant is very intelligent and cunning, and because of this is probably more dangerous than if he were not so astute. He recommended the judge impose a maximum sentence. Carrie arrived at the Weber County Courthouse in Ogden for sentencing on November 2nd, 1987. He walked down the hallway in an orange jumpsuit and handcuffs, pausing to show a TV news camera a thick blue book he carried.
Utah Court Rules Annotated. Did you get that?
The investigator presented his findings to the judge, who then handed down the sentence. Two terms of 15 years to life and one term of 5 to life, all to run concurrently at the same time. It was the most the judge could give. The sentence carried what's known as a minimum mandatory, meaning Carrie couldn't get out until he had served at least 15 years. The earliest he could hope to leave prison would be sometime around 2003.
And so that was pretty much the assumption of everyone, that he'll do 15 years.
Prosecutor Reed Richards had secured the strongest possible penalty. He tried to suppress a smile when speaking to reporters in this tape from after the sentencing hearing.
Because of the type of situation that this young lady was in, the vulnerability that she had, the other things in his background that really couldn't come out at trial and appropriately did not come out at trial, but are appropriate sentence, I think the sentence was well pondered upon by the judge and appropriate.
But then Reed still had to decide what to do with the other three cases, which were still waiting to go to trial. The three women remained reluctant, not wanting to go through what Caroline had on the witness stand. Reed told them he couldn't promise Carrie would spend any more than 15 years in prison because that decision would be up to the Utah Board of Pardons and Parole.
And they can keep him as long as they want to keep him. But if you want to move ahead, we're very happy to do that. And I don't remember any of them being anxious to move ahead.
Reed told the victims if they chose not to go to trial, police reports from their cases would still be sent to the parole board.
Once you've got the conviction, you can say, gee, the Board of Pardons will know what your report is. It's not a conviction because they have to realize that maybe you could have been mistaken, but at least they're going to know what you said. And they're going to know the evidence in this case and the confessions that he made and so forth.
The three women confirmed they didn't want to testify. Reed promised to seek another solution.
I think the decision to probably not go ahead on those others was a good decision from the victim standpoint and from the case overall.
Reed proposed a plea deal to Carrie's defense attorney, Kevin Sullivan. He'd reduce the charges in one of the three remaining cases, and if Carrie pleaded guilty to it, he'd drop the charges in the other two. Kevin said he'd take the offer to Carrie, but they'd need some time to think it over. Meantime, Reed wondered what to do with the Cherie Warren case.
It's much better in a murder case to have a dead body than to just be saying she disappeared and we think he killed her. So the decision was made, let's keep investigating it, and he's not going anywhere. Let's see if we can find some additional information. Maybe we can find the body.
There were new clues in the search for Cherie. Police had subpoenaed Carey's time cards from Weber State College to see what he'd been doing on the dates of the various rapes. The college had turned over records that also covered the time of Cherie's disappearance. I've reviewed them myself. They show Carey had taken the day after Cherie's disappearance off, marking it as 8 hours of vacation time. Which means Carey potentially had the opportunity to take Cherie's car to Vegas the night of her disappearance and return to Utah the next morning without raising suspicion at work.
I don't know why a guy from here would take a car and dump it somewhere in Las Vegas. That's kind of weird.
Carey had taken another 8 hours of vacation time the following Sunday, the day the elk hunting guide, Fred Johns, had reported seeing him on the mountain behind Causey Reservoir.
There wasn't really a motive there. Why would you kill your girlfriend?
The two ladies who had lived upstairs from Carey and who'd reported hearing a loud argument followed by a thump had suggested a possible answer. Cherie might have learned of Carey's activities with other women, confronted him, then died in a burst of reactionary violence. But Reed wasn't going to charge Carey based on this unproven theory.
Well, yeah, you'd have to first get over the idea that she may not be dead, and that's probably, if I were the defense attorney, an angle that I would push pretty hard. I'd talk about the trouble she was having at home, the dispute she had with her ex-husband. She may have had other family problems, and why not find a new boyfriend or just disappear and start a new life? So really, if you charge a case like that, and if you can get through the preliminary hearing where you've got to show probable cause, then you're ending up with a trial, and if you go to trial and don't get a conviction, you're all done. You've got double jeopardy that steps in, and even if you get perfect proof later on, you're dead. So there's really an incentive to not do it until you think you've got enough to really convict, and that's why it was not filed back then.
The stories of Kaylin and Mary, the women who had lived above Carey in October of 85, suggested Cherie might have made it to Carey's apartment on the night she disappeared. Former Ogden Police Detective Shane Miner told me that this once again raised a question for police. Who had jurisdiction? Because Carey lived in Ogden.
So it would have made it an Ogden case.
Ogden police did go back and check Carey's basement apartment for any sign of Cherie Warren's blood, but they didn't find anything.
But this was information we got 2 years after the fact, and he had moved from that apartment.
Ogden police hadn't kept any files or evidence on Cherie's case up to that point, leaving the task to Roy Police Detective Jack Bell. But Shane and his fellow Ogden detectives, Chris Zimmerman and John Stubbs, found themselves sucked into the Cherie Warren case through their work on the Ogden City rapist investigation.
So there was a case number generated and reports were written under that.
The Ogden detectives had interviewed several of Carey's friends, members of the so-called Supper Club, and filed reports about those interviews in their department's record system. Copies of those reports did not make their way back to Jack Bell. The Cherie Warren investigation had effectively forked.
And then there was another component to that was Salt Lake was having a lot of things happening down there. So when she went missing out of Salt Lake, I think that got grouped into a bunch of unsolved stuff in the Salt Lake area at that period of time.
In the last couple episodes, we talked about how Salt Lake City police had tied three unsolved murders of young women to a single handgun. They had formed a task force to hunt a suspected serial killer. Cherie's name had ended up on the task force's list of possible victims since she'd last been seen in Salt Lake.
And that was it. There was no other connections down there other than that.
But Ogden and Roy police had sent a couple pieces of evidence to Salt Lake, including one of the psychic letters I mentioned in a previous episode. As a result, bits and pieces of the Cherie Warren case were scattered across three police departments that weren't always great about talking to one another.
Did that cause any issues for you as you kind of set out to pull all of the information from the different places together?
Yeah, kind of.
But Shane Miner told me the bigger issue for police investigating the Cherie Warren case at that point was they hadn't been able to challenge Carey Hartman about any of the new evidence that had emerged since his arrest, because Carey had lawyered up and invoked his right to remain silent.
Yeah, I mean, what did he have to say? We don't know other than that story that he gave to Neumeier.
Michael Neumeier was Carey's private investigator. You heard Carey's statement to Neumeier in Episode 3.
Which is a lot of what his thoughts are, but it doesn't tell you anything as far as what's going on with him and Cherie at the time she went missing.
Cary Hartman arrived at the Utah State Prison in November of 87 to begin serving his sentence.
But then once he goes there, they classify him and they decide where he goes. And that's where he'd ended up.
Department of Corrections problem at that point.
Yes.
Prison staff put Cary through their classification protocol. It assigned him medium security status and listed him as Sigma, a designation for inmates with calm, easygoing personalities. Cary immediately requested a transfer to a small jail in rural San Pete County. He told prison staff his life would be at risk if they kept him at the main prison because he was a former police officer. I've never been to prison, so I'm not sure if 2 years as a volunteer unpaid reserve officer is enough to get a person blacklisted by the bad guys. But the newspaper stories about Cary's trial had identified him as a former cop. The Utah Department of Corrections approved Cary's request and moved him to the San Pete County Jail in the interest of his own safety. This was a coup for Cary. In San Pete County, he'd live around fewer serious felons, under less strict supervision than at the state prison. His girlfriend slash fiance, Shauna Hall, soon moved to the town of Manti in San Pete County so she could visit Cary more regularly. They still intended to marry. The Department of Corrections shipped Cary back to the Weber County Courthouse a few months into his stay for a plea hearing. Cary had decided to take the deal Prosecutor Reed Richards had offered. The judge asked if he had, in fact, committed the rape in question. Cary said, quote, "Yes, sir." He received a sentence of 5 years to life, but the clock would run at the same time as his other sentence, meaning no additional prison time. Still, Reed told the TV news cameras it felt like a good result.
And probably the overriding consideration was that we had three gals who didn't really want to go in and tell the whole world the story of what had happened to them. And we were able to avoid that, and I think that's maybe the greatest victory of obtaining a plea.
Ogden police were not similarly satisfied. They still had a pile of unsolved rape cases they believed, but couldn't prove, Cary might have committed.
But you're working off of that limited information and trying to make something out of it.
Detectives like Shane Miner wondered if, now that Cary was in custody for at least 15 years, he might be more willing to talk. They decided to pay Cary a visit.
I've done that similar thing before. Sometimes it works out. Most of the time it doesn't.
Shane Miner and Chris Zimmerman made the three-hour drive from Ogden to Manti to visit Cary at the San Pete County Jail.
We had went down there to talk to him, and
he recognizes both of you guys.
Yeah.
Zimmerman told Cary he wanted to talk about the unsolved rapes. Cary declined. Okay. Zimmerman instead suggested they talk about the disappearance of Cherie Warren.
There wasn't no conversation. He just seen who it was and turned around, walked out, and didn't say nothing to us.
The Ogden Standard Examiner published an article about this fruitless effort to interview Cary. A clipping of the article found its way to Cherie's friend and former coworker, Pam Volk.
I don't remember who it was. I think it might have been my mom sent me an article from the paper. Because, you know, this was before the internet, this was before cell phones, all that kind of stuff.
You might remember Pam from episode one. She had dated Cary herself before he had started seeing Cherie. Pam later married a German man, and they had moved overseas in 86. Pam hadn't imagined Cary could have been a suspect in Cherie's disappearance.
Yeah, no, I learned that. In fact, I learned that when we were in Germany.
Pam had stayed in touch with Cary by letter prior to his arrest. She had asked for updates on the search for Cherie. Cary's replies came to an abrupt stop after May of 87.
And I was like, holy sh**, what have I done? You know, what kind of a person was I to date somebody like that? Made me feel really bad. Sorry. But I also felt really bad because that's how Cherie and he got together. And in the time since, I have, after I realized what kind of a person he is, I think that he might have been the one that did something to Cherie. But I don't know why, you know? I don't know what would make him do that, you know? Because he'd never, I mean, all these women that he raped, he'd never, you know, killed anybody, you know? So, yeah. That was a rough time.
Carrie Hartman's fiancé, Shauna Hall, finalized her divorce from her husband in early 1988. I'm not sure exactly when or how, but Carrie would later say he and Shauna were married at the San Pete County Jail where he was housed. Around that same time, Carrie received a letter from his childhood best friend, Steve Bartlett. Here's what it said.
This may be the hardest letter I ever write. Of course, I've been reading the newspaper and watching television, so I know what you've been doing. Carrie, why?
I mentioned Bartlett in episode 3. He was the special investigator for the Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office.
I keep remembering all the great things we did together growing up. I knew we would always be friends and we could talk to each other no matter what happened in life.
Carrie had claimed to have called Bartlett shortly after Cherie Warren disappeared and asked for his help in looking for her around Salt Lake City.
As a Christian, I still want to know what happened to Cherie. So if you have the guts to tell me, I will locate her and put an end to her family's agony. I can't make promises, but I am interested in finding her and not causing you any more legal problems.
A magnanimous offer and show of friendship from Steve Bartlett. Here's Carrie's reply.
Steve, you are my oldest friend. I forgive you your insecurities toward me. I've never lied to you. Never. And I'm going to tell you how it is, okay? All you hear or read is shit.
Carrie went on to attack the evidence in the rape case. He said he had never confessed, never been picked out of a lineup, and couldn't possibly have been responsible. The rape kit evidence had included sperm, which he didn't produce because of his vasectomy.
Next, I have zero knowledge of Cherie's whereabouts, then or now. End of story. I loved her, Steve.
Carrie included a newspaper clipping with his letter. It described a home invasion rape that had occurred in Ogden weeks earlier, long after Carrie was in custody. It wasn't the only one. They had kept happening.
How about the 15 attacks in Ogden, in the same area, same MO, while I was in the Weber County Jail? How about the 5 attacks about 2 weeks ago? Same exact everything. They are still happening. Help me by finding the asshole out there and getting the truth out of him.
Carrie wasn't making this up. Former Ogden Police Detective Shane Miner told me Carrie's arrest had not put an end to the string of home invasion rapes plaguing the city, which didn't make sense.
It started to become obvious we're dealing with a couple of different people.
There were two Ogden City rapists. This second serial rapist operated in a very similar manner, with some subtle differences.
He started to see two different type of MOs developing. One maybe more verbally violent, the other was more violent, more physically violent, if that makes sense to you.
This second serial rapist accelerated his attacks in early 88, assaulting 3 different women in the space of a single week that March. Detectives had believed Carrie had stalked the women in his cases, most of whom lived near him. The second serial rapist seemed more random.
He could park his car down at 10th and Wall in Ogden Avenue, but he would hit the opposite end of town, and he would be on foot all night long in the city.
Police responded to the home of yet another victim on the morning of Saturday, April 2nd. They spotted a man acting suspicious nearby. They confronted and arrested him. Blaine Nelson, the second Ogden City rapist. Ogden Police Captain Marlon Balls described Blaine's methods to the news media.
He looked for homes that were open during the early morning hours. If a female was alone inside the house, an opportunity presented itself, then he sexually assaulted her. If she was not alone, there was a man present in the home, why a lot of times just money was stolen.
Blaine and Carrie's styles were similar enough to cause confusion. They even looked a bit alike, though Blaine was younger and thinner than Carrie.
Which one was the copycat of which one, I don't know.
Weber County Attorney Reed Richards filed charges against Blaine in connection with 4 separate cases, far fewer than police believed he had committed. Reed told me Blaine was
very candid and very willing to talk about what he'd done. He talked about the fact that after he'd commit these rapes, he'd actually hide close by because he wanted to watch all the action.
Blaine even admitted he had followed the news coverage of Carrie Hartman's arrest almost a year earlier and realized if he had stopped attacking women then, no one would look for him. Blaine returned to court 2 weeks later. Several of the women he had attacked were there too. One lunged at him as he walked down the hallway in handcuffs. Defense attorney John Kane told reporters that day Blaine had wanted to clean his soul, even for crimes Ogden police didn't know about.
He told the officers not only about incidents here in Weber County, but also down in Iron County, Box Elder County, states of Arizona and Wyoming. And he wanted to make a complete clean breast of everything.
Blaine pleaded guilty to the charges prosecutor Reed Richards had filed against him.
He's pled to 13 first-degree felonies. Nine of those carry a minimum mandatory prison term. You can't really get much more than that out of a person. He can only do so much time in prison.
In exchange for the guilty pleas, Reed agreed not to file about 60 additional counts for other rapes he believed Blaine had committed.
Blaine Nelson told state prosecutors, the judge, and the victims today he's willing to die if it would undo the pain he's inflicted.
That if God would take my life and erase from the minds of the victims what they went through, I would die.
KSL-TV reporter Larry Lewis covered Blaine Nelson's case, just as he had with the other Ogden City rapist, his friend, Kerry Hartman.
I feel good. I feel that I should do what they sentenced me with for what I've done.
Blaine granted Larry a one-on-one interview following his sentencing.
Nelson says his addiction to cocaine and pain pills drove him to burglarize homes looking for more drugs, and then rape the women who lived there. Nelson hopes that by speaking out, he can stop others from making the mistakes he made.
Drugs do make you do things that you're not aware of. They make your mind yield to temptations or Satan.
Blaine had committed so many rapes, investigators doubted even he could keep them all straight. It suddenly made sense why young single women in Ogden had lived in such fear during the mid-80s. Blaine Nelson's tearful confession on television couldn't atone for the terror he had dealt to an entire generation of women. Every creak or groan in an otherwise quiet house at night might really have been the work of the Ogden City rapist. But for Kerry Hartman, the admissions of Blaine Nelson were a godsend. He found in Blaine a perfect patsy, a scapegoat upon whom he could place all the blame for his crimes. Kerry again wrote to his old friend, the district attorney's special investigator, Steve Bartlett, to insist he had been framed.
I did not do the crimes that I am here for. No way in hell. You have the option of believing the media and the police or me.
Bartlett chose not to believe Kerry.
Yes, there have been other attacks and rapes, and the suspects have been similar to you. The fact remains that you have been convicted based on evidence introduced. But there is a ton more evidence that the judge and jury never got to know about.
And Bartlett brought up the matter of Cherie Warren. With everything that had come out about Kerry's abusive, manipulative treatment of women, before, during, and after the time he had dated Cherie, how could he not be responsible for her disappearance?
I also feel you are withholding what you really know about Cherie. Friends don't lie to friends, remember?
But Kerry held fast to his denial.
This is the truth. I have absolutely no knowledge of Cherie's whereabouts, nor do I have any knowledge of what happened to her. That is the truth.
I don't know if Kerry Hartman ever truly loved Cherie Warren. They'd only dated for around 6 months, and Kerry had proposed marriage to his next girlfriend, Shauna Hall, within about a year of Cherie's disappearance. But his jailhouse wedding to Shauna in early 1988 imploded almost immediately. Prison records show Shauna sent Kerry a Dear John letter after only a few months of their union. I can't find a court record for a divorce, which means their marriage was probably annulled. There are only a few reasons under Utah law that could have happened. One would have been if Shauna's prior marriage wasn't fully ended by the time she swore vows to Kerry. In any case, in May of 88, the Utah Department of Corrections moved Kerry from the San Pete County Jail to another facility, 150 miles away in Iron County. This put an end to his visits with Shauna. Carey wasn't the only Ogden City rapist to land in the Iron County Correctional Facility that summer. Blaine Nelson headed there too, after his sentencing in Ogden.
All this is off my chest now. I can basically try to go forward. I know, you know, 30 years is the rest of my life.
Blaine was at that time facing additional charges in Iron County, where he had admitted to attacking several women. A judge there sentenced him that August, adding 35 years to Blaine's sentence. It meant Blaine would likely never live another day as a free man. Blaine and Carey crossed paths while they were both in the Iron County Jail that summer.
But of course, once they're down at prison together and talking, who knows what they come up with.
Former Weber County Attorney Reed Richards received a letter from Blaine soon afterward, in which Blaine claimed to have committed the two rapes for which Carey was serving time.
Then you get the question of, well, which one of them was it?
Blaine wrote other letters to other lawyers, asking them to get involved, to help clear Carey Hartman. But Reed wasn't buying it, in part because Blaine didn't have B-type blood.
So I don't know how that happened to be there, if it was him that did it.
Remember, Carey had B-type blood, and the crime lab had found B-type blood in the forensic evidence from the case he had gone to trial on, but not the others.
Well, and I don't know that we still know which ones he did and which ones Nelson did.
Reed suspected Carey and Blaine had cut some kind of deal.
And there was some talk of a third person, too.
Yes, there was a third serial rapist active in Ogden during this same period. His name was Jerry Casita.
So you got three people, and I don't know that any of us know exactly which ones which did, because once the reports are in the paper, they can give you quite a lot of detail just from what they've read in the paper, I suppose.
In the spring of 89, Carey collected sworn affidavits from three people who each claimed to have at different times and in different places heard Blaine Nelson admitting to Carey's crimes. Two of those witnesses were inmates, but the third was a clergy member for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints who taught religion to inmates. That church leader even wrote a letter to the Utah Attorney General's office. He wrote, quote, "Blaine's comments have caused me to believe that there is some doubt as to Carey's guilt or innocence." If Carey Hartman could convince enough people to share that same doubt, it might be enough to overturn his conviction. Carey sat for an interview with a social worker in November of 88, about a year into his sentence. He wanted into a sex offender therapy program. I have a copy of the social worker's notes. She wrote Carey was above average in intellectual functioning. The notes include direct quotations from Carey. He talked about his dad.
"He's a wonderful man, and our relationship was excellent. He has great wisdom. He was not always the best listener. He didn't really support me. He was too busy being right. He's a dictator, emperor, king of the Hartman family."
And Carey talked about his mom.
"Mom only hears what she wants to hear. She's naive and unattached. She is warm-hearted and emotional, but she's extremely critical. She was insecure with Dad because of his dominance."
Carey was the oldest of four kids in his family. He said he was closest to his baby sister Sheila, hadn't talked to his brother Jack in at least a year, and had a strained relationship with his sister Jill.
"More than anything, I enjoy spending time with my two sons."
She asked Carey to list positive attributes about himself. He said he was articulate and honest. She then asked for some negatives. Carey said he could be moody, was bad at handling money, and lacked a sense of self-worth. When it came to Carey's sexual habits, Carey grew circumspect.
"I found out about and tried masturbation at age 14. I found out from some cousins. I first found out about sex at 15 from some kids at school."
He wouldn't say what he thought about sex, what his parents thought about it, or what his friends thought about it. The social worker wrote Carey insisted on his innocence of any rape or sexual assault. He only wanted in the sex offender therapy program for help with his habit of making obscene phone calls. He refused to answer any of her questions about the specifics of the charges that had put him in prison. Carrie was admitted to the therapy program. It required he write an autobiography. He sometimes read portions of it aloud during group sessions. The social worker wrote Carrie one time recited a, quote, very detailed account of the disappearance of his girlfriend. To my frustration, she didn't write specifically what Carrie said about it. But her notes also say Carrie admitted to holding back some of the detail because he didn't trust his fellow inmates. In a follow-up report a few months later, the social worker wrote Carrie worked very hard to, quote, control the anger that seems to be brewing inside. That anger manifested when Carrie talked about why he was in prison. He said he was innocent and called the jury that had convicted him incompetent.
Two old ladies on the jury slept through the trial.
And he made sexist remarks about the women he had attacked.
The victims were there, testifying and looking very virginal in dress and manner.
But he had a plan to win back his freedom. His conviction was on appeal to the Utah Supreme Court. Carrie's appeal didn't argue factual innocence. It didn't say he hadn't raped Caroline. Instead, his lawyer argued Carrie had been overcharged and oversentenced because he'd only threatened to blow Caroline's children's heads off. He hadn't actually put a gun to their heads. The justices of the Utah Supreme Court were unmoved. They rejected Carrie's appeal in a unanimous decision issued in November of 1989. Carrie seemed to take the setback in stride. A few days later, he wrote a letter to Roy Police Detective Jack Bell.
Dear Jack, I'll bet you're surprised to hear from me, so I'll get to the point. How are you coming on Cherie's disappearance? Have you once even thought about contacting Unsolved Mysteries about the case?
Unsolved Mysteries was a network TV series that aired during the 80s and 90s. It was a blend of true crime reenactments and paranormal malarkey. Actor Robert Stack hosted.
Join me. You may be able to help solve a mystery.
I want to find her as badly as you do, so give it a try. I didn't have anything to do with her disappearance, Jack. You know that.
Carrie almost seemed to mock Jack in this letter, taunting him over the failed search for Cherie.
That's what the letter meant to me. More manipulation.
But Carrie didn't write just to needle Jack. He wanted his old high school classmate to know he was about to play the card he had tucked up his sleeve. It had to do with an emerging science. DNA.
I am not guilty of the charges I am here for. I think you realize that also. And I am about to prove it.
On the next episode of Cold.
I'm not a fruitcake. I'm not a crackpot. I'm level-headed. I'm sane.
You make a very passionate and a very persuasive plea that you are innocent.
If you have information about the disappearance of Cherie Warren, now is the time to share it. You can reach me by emailing cold@ksl.com or contact the Roy City Police Department at 801-774-1063. I also want you to know, if you've experienced abuse or sexual violence, you're not alone. There are trained experts ready to listen and help. In the United States, survivors of rape and sexual assault can connect to free resources through the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network at rainn.org. If you or someone you know is experiencing domestic abuse in any form, you can reach the National Domestic Violence Hotline at thehotline.org. Cold is a production of KSL Podcasts and Wondery in association with Workhouse Media. Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Cold ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Cold is researched, written, and hosted by me, Dave Cawley. Audio production and sound design by Ben Kiebrick and Aaron Mason. Mixing and mastering by Ben Kiebrick. Michael Bonmiller composed our main theme, with additional music this season by Allison Leighton Brown. Additional voices in this episode provided by
John Green,
Francis Cook,
Kevin LaRue,
Aaron Mason,
Ryan Meeks,
with
Eric Openshaw,
and
Ken Fall.
My personal thanks to our editorial team, Amy Donaldson, Andrea Smartin, Ryan Meeks, Becky Bruce, Kira Faramond, Kellyanne Halverson, Josh Tilton, and Felix Bennell. For Amazon Music and Wondery, managing producer Candice Manriquez-Wren, producer Claire Chambers, senior producer Lizzie Bassett, and executive producer Morgan Jones. Special thanks to Cale Bittner and Allison Vermeulen, with Workhouse Media executive producers Paul Anderson and Nick Pinella. And for KSL Podcasts, executive producer Cheryl Worsley. For pictures and more, go to our website, thecoldpodcast.com, and follow us on social at The Cold Podcast. Most of all, thank you for listening.
I understand that anybody who's paid attention to the media would have to come to the conclusion that I killed my wife.
Hi, my name is Zach Stewart Pontier. I'm one of the filmmakers behind The Jinx, and I'm excited to bring you the official Jinx podcast. We'll be revisiting all six episodes of Part 1 and watching along with Part 2 as it airs on Max, starting April 21st.
Bye-bye.
The official Jinx podcast. Listen on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.